You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, I'll be joined by my guests Alessio Patalano and James Rogers to discuss the day's top news stories, including the easier said than done ceasefire for Syria. Will it happen? Will it hold? And does it even matter as Bashar al-Assad declares his intention to fight on? NATO's upscaling of its presence in Europe, obviously a signal to Russia, but will Moscow read it as written? The EU's three-month ultimatum to Greece to sort its borders out. What happens if, or realistically when, the terms are not met? The imminent disappearance of a broadsheet from British newsstands. Did it have to end this way for The Independent? And is Ukraine preparing to wreak revenge against Russia at Eurovision? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are James Rogers and Alessio Patalano. James Rogers is a senior lecturer in journalism at City University London. Alessio Patalano is a lecturer in war studies at King's College London. Alessio is the one wearing the bow tie. Anyway, welcome both back to the show. We will start tonight with Syria. Now, last night, various interested onlookers gathered in Munich, a city which you would think would have fallen from the International War Avoiding Conference calendar, what with one thing and another. They declared that a ceasefire would descend across Syria 1 week hence. More or less as they were doing so, it now transpires President Bashar al-Assad was giving an interview to AFP in which he swore that he would retake the whole country, which does not sound terrifically ceasefire-y. Alessio, first of all, the ceasefire plan. If it is as easy as everyone just getting together and announcing that there's going to be one, why haven't we had a crack at this before now?
The short answer is I don't know, and I'm not really sure that it actually matters in the sense that it's going to be very difficult to enforce. I mean, the key issue is that is I think we're in a different place today. There's a lot of exhaustion. The situation has changed. Russia is much more prominent in the operation. So certainly that contributed to create a political willingness to engage with this debate again. But it doesn't change what awaits at the end, at the other end of that spectrum. That is how easy is going to be to implement. Well, it isn't going to be easy to implement. Partly because, as Bashar Assad said himself, there is a situation by which he will continue to fight terrorism. Now, we should open a debate about what is his definition of terrorism.
It's a fairly broad one, I think.
I think so. So that's a key problem, because how can you possibly implement the ceasefire where at the same time you are also saying, oh, by the way, we'll continue to fight on, and that's one of the important preconditions for us to get to a better place. So, again, besides the diplomatic willingness to try to create the condition for a ceasefire, I don't think that on the ground things, the perspective that we're looking at is a particularly sort of positive one.
James, is this ceasefire, is it largely, I've been wondering, is it symbolic? Is it a signal? And is that signal to all the warring parties in Syria from the rest of the world, basically, seriously, we're sick of this, please knock it off?
I think that's certainly what they're trying to do. I mean, these talks and this agreement, we'll wait and see how it actually unfolds, have been prompted by the fact that the last attempt to start substantial negotiations a week ago failed. And so this is, if you like, the second best option. To pick up on what Alessio said about terrorism, well, I think Mr. Assad's definition of terrorist is anyone who opposes him, really. And I think we
Absolutely.
Can expect that, buoyed by particularly Russia's air support and indeed by Russia's political and diplomatic support, he feels within 24 hours of this agreement, if such it is being announced, he feels bullish enough to say that he intends to recapture the whole of Syrian territory, an objective which has barely been realistic, frankly, for the last 5 years. But he feels bold enough to give an interview to an international news agency to say that. So. And of course, Russia is allowed to continue bombing terrorist targets. What exactly does that mean?
Assad's forces have, of course, been advancing with no small amount of help from their Russian allies. They do really have, in the particular war that they're fighting with anti-Assad rebels, they have the only air force in the field, and that's generally been fairly decisive in recent military history. Alessio, have we reached a point, and it occurs to me that, or at least this is how it seems to me, I could be misreading things drastically, that basically, like it or not, and I don't think many people do like it, Bashar al-Assad has won this war, and they're now trying to figure out the details?
To an extent, I think you're right in the sense that it depends very much on what the objective of this war is supposed to be. Obviously, militarily, it is the superior sort of force, and now that it's got all the sort of supports that it requires in terms of supporting its own ground operation from the air, it has the decisive edge. So from a military point of view, of course, it's probably going to win this war. But what is the ultimate objective? Try to bring a country together again under its firm controlling grasp, and not so sure that objective will be met. That will this is the kind of issue that will sort of stay there far longer after war has been declared to be won by any one party.
Because it just also again seems to me that the I could say the between the lines or the body language of the Western world, especially since the refugee crisis began to affect Europe quite dramatically, there seems to me at least to be a general view in the West that really all we care about is this stops, and we care about that more than whether about who actually wins. And frankly, if Russia wants Syria that badly, they're welcome to it.
Well, I think that's true, and I think on a human level, one has to welcome this if it stops a few people being killed after
the
most conservative estimate, the United Nations ones, and they stopped counting, unless I'm mistaken, about 18 months ago. Their estimate, again, a conservative one, was 250,000 people have been killed. We've seen estimates published this week suggesting the real figure might be almost twice as much as that. So, I think the question comes into here of what Russia's objectives are. Russia's objectives were probably to re-establish itself on the international stage. Mr. Putin had a message to send to his domestic audience as well as to the international one. Russia does not want to stay there for a long time and get bogged down. The memory of Afghanistan and the long and eventually disastrous campaign which the Soviet Union fought then is still very much in the minds of Russia's military and political elite. So I suspect Russia may be looking within the next few months to try to declare victory and get out themselves.
Is there, and I'll ask you both this question before we move along, I'll ask you first, Alessio, is it possible, and with apologies in advance for asking you to, like, guess the future of the Middle East, which is basically just asking guests to make complete fools of themselves. But a year from now, what do we think Syria looks like?
Oh, that's a very good question.
Thought you'd like it.
Yeah. Also, you should add that as a historian, historians always get it wrong when it comes to giving predictions. And really, I'm on the safer side of the fence in this story, no matter what I say. But I think, you know, there's two different stories here. There's the humanitarian sort of tragedy that's been alluded a moment ago, and I think that will be pretty much as it is today, if not worse. Actually, very likely in a year time, we're looking at a worse situation than the one we have now. So that picture is bleak. There's nothing really at the moment suggesting that it's going to get any better. And there's the political one. I think in a year time we'll be in a better place because there will be a sense of having surrendered politically and diplomatically the fact there is another alternative to Assad. And you're just making peace with it. And today, I think we're still sort of trying not to, if you think about it, this has been always the Russian position since day one. And it's taken a long time for everybody else to try sort of to digest it, to see if there were any alternatives and then to come along. And I think in a year time, that's pretty much where we're going to be. Is the sort of the connection between the Syrian conflict and sort of the wider problem of the Middle East and sort of the terrorism sort of dimension could be solved again? I don't think it's going to be changed, because at least a very big chunk of that issue with this humanitarian crisis is going to be there. It's going to be worse than it is today. So it depends very much on how, I suppose, you want to zoom in and provide the details of the answer. You're going to get a slightly different answer to it.
James, finally, what do you think?
I mean, I think the answer to the question, I mean, you began this segment, Andrew, by asking why no one had a crack at this before, and I think that is a very good question. I think the answer, briefly, to your question depends upon whether the outside parties decide to concentrate their efforts primarily diplomatically or militarily. We've seen reports this week suggesting that both Saudi Arabia and Turkey have plans to deploy troops there. If that happens, then clearly things are going to get markedly worse. If, however, These discussions we've seen in Munich are form the basis for greater cooperation between the United States and Russia. Then who knows? Maybe there may be a brighter future to look forward to.
Okay, well, let's move along now to a sort of Russia-related story. At first glance, the news that NATO is to send forces to Europe to deter Russia would appear to have rather a dog bites man quality to it. Deterring Russia in Europe is pretty much NATO's job description. Nor is Russia bristling at NATO deployments exactly unprecedented. Moscow affects outrage at any troop movement east of approximately Brussels. But NATO's latest announcement and the Kremlin's latest conniption are significant. NATO is promising its biggest build-up in Europe since the Cold War. Alessio, what is there any actual, like militarily, is there any strategic point to this? Russia knows what NATO has. It knows what NATO is capable of.
I think there is, because we have an element of reassurance of those who feel, especially in the Baltic states and in Eastern Europe, they feel like they are much more exposed. So there's an element of reassuring people that are within NATO, some of the member, the NATO member countries. And that's one element. But also the type of deployments that we're looking at. This is sort of an arrangement by which the stated objective is to increase the pre-deployment, so to have readily available forces, so to increase the scale, sort of scale up in case you have to man an operation, which at the moment would be much more difficult because in geographic terms NATO is just much more sort of far away from the possible objective. So it is an element, I suppose, of credible conventional deterrence in terms of pre-deploying forces that would allow for a quick scale-up if something was to come along. And in a way, the key message here is, Russia, be careful. We're not going to be sort of taken completely by surprise if you try to do something else, because we're going to have the means in place to respond very quickly. Whether this type of message is going to be sort of understood in the Kremlin this way, that's a different story entirely.
Well, I guess to put that point to you, James, is there an argument that this kind of build-up makes some sort of Russian overreaction or miscalculation more likely?
I think it certainly makes it possible. I think in terms of how the message is likely to be received in the Kremlin, and in terms of the way which it will be portrayed for Russian domestic consumption, it's going to be, see, I told you, we're back. Mm. Look, NATO's going to have to pay attention to us now. Look at them. There's two ways that they can play this. They can either say, look, we were right to act as we have done in Ukraine. We were right to draw these lines because NATO remains as it was right throughout the Cold War, an aggressor. They can portray it that way. Or they can say, NATO, look, has to take us seriously again. And so they're having to respond to us like this. So I think in terms of domestic political consumption, it will be exactly what the Kremlin probably wants.
Is there also, I just wonder, Alessio, thinking out loud, if there's an element of self-reinforcement here for NATO as well? Is it, I guess, persuading themselves that they would actually fight World War III over Narva or Dag of Pils or conceivably the eastern reaches of Finland, which isn't in NATO, but the point would stand, I think.
Well, I'm not sure if the thinking is about World War III, but certainly there is a sense of rebuilding a part of the job description of NATO, as you put it earlier on, that has been sort of put on the backside for a relatively long period of time. You know, the fact that, what is interesting is that on a slightly related note, recently two or three sort of the strategic documents coming out of the United States that all started to point out that great power competition is back. And they're all pointing out that for the past quarter of a century, we haven't been talking about it, we haven't been thinking about it. That's a wake-up call. Russia and China, they are developing capabilities to that would suggest they're trying to position themselves as global power, etc., etc. And so in this respect, I think this is a wake-up call for NATO. It's like, well, guys, we've been saying we do this stuff, but we haven't really been doing it for a very long period of time. Perhaps it's about time to start thinking about what it would be looking like, a sort of state-on-state gauging and the sort of competition that we haven't really been addressing on a practical way, which is what NATO at the beginning was designed to do for a very, very long time.
But James, I guess finally on this before we move along, is there any reason to suppose that this kind of build-up by NATO will actually cause Russia to modify its behaviour at all? Or is the, because the problem is, it strikes me at least, and this is just basic power dynamics, Russia can't allow itself to be seen to be modifying its behaviour in response to this kind of thing. NATO has said that one of the things that has been exercising them, not without reason, is Russia's recent habit of flying very, very close, or indeed into NATO airspace, often with the transponders switched off, which is the dangers of which are self-evident. But the trouble is, Russia doesn't get left with anywhere to run, does it? Russia is being basically invited to step up.
Well, possibly. I mean, I think Russia might also take the view that, well, we better just call it off for a while, and we better just cut down the number of our flights for a while, and then we can turn them up again if we feel like doing that. I mean, I think particularly given that if there is to be a solution found in Syria, and however that turns out, it's in everybody's interest in the longer term. Both have got big strategic concerns there. Russia over involvement, the West particularly over the role of Islamic State. So there is also a need for cooperation. The last thing I think that either Russia or NATO or the wider West needs is for a confrontation to develop over Northern Europe.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with James Rogers and Alessio Patilano. Coming up next, the EU gives Greece 3 months to sort out its borders, which you can only wish them luck with.
Travel in comfort with the help of the Monocle Shop. It's the place to select the best bags, passport wallets, travel guides, and, of course, the latest issue of the magazine to entertain you on your lounger. We have a great lineup of special collaboration bags with Porter in Japan, including the new Overnighter bag, ideal for a city weekend trip. And then there's the limited edition Remova multi-wheel, made from lightweight polycarbonate in a special monocle edition. Visit our stores in London, New York, Toronto, Singapore, Tokyo, and Hong Kong, or shop online at monocle.com. Be the one turning heads at the luggage carousel.
You're welcome back to Midori House and Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are this evening's guests, James Rogers and Alessio Patilano. Now, having spent much of the last few years being yelled at by the EU for failing to keep its finances in order, Greece is now being yelled at by the EU for failing to do the same with its borders. As the guardian of the EU's southeast flank, Greece has been used as a way station by unceasing processions of migrants, 850,000 last year alone, and those were just the ones anyone actually counted. Now, the EU has given Athens 3 months to sort this out. James, as far as it's possible to tell, is it actually sortable outable?
I suspect it probably isn't. I mean, there may be more that can be done at the moment, but I mean, obviously, as people who've tried to look at the wider situation would suggest, the problems would start with, a bigger solution would start with addressing the cause of it, which is the war in Syria, which we've been discussing. That's not going to be easily sorted out. And the second is where else would these refugees go? I mean, people don't, with some very few exceptions, people don't tend to leave their homes and everything they've left behind, everything they've ever known, if they've got a realistic prospect of staying there, which most of the people trying to cross the Mediterranean clearly do not. So, and also, if we consider the geography there, the reason why people are trying to cross there is because it's a very short distance from Turkey to Greece, and because there are a lot of islands to which they can cross.
Well, indeed so. There's not only the land border between them, it's the very short ocean routes, hazardous though they clearly are, between Turkey and islands like Lesbos. Alessio, we've seen the deployment, or at least NATO announcing that it's going to send warships to the Aegean this week. Is that actually going to make any difference to anything?
Well, I haven't seen the details about the mandate that will be given, but my guesstimate is that probably not going to be a massive difference, because unless it is for a border patrol, which I'm not sure how you would justify it in the NATO context, they're probably going to be there. Again, you have to see the kind of mandate they have. To date, the only functioning operation in the Mediterranean that managed to avoid a disaster and at the same time to operate as a border control measure was Mare Nostrum, the operation that was conducted by the Italian Navy. Everything else that's been sort of tested afterwards proved to be just not effective, because either you don't have enough assets, either you have not enough money to sustain the operation. I think what is happening at the moment, again, is very unclear. what is interesting to see is precisely the kind of mandate that will tell you something about the extent to which it's going to be a complete disaster, absolutely pointless, or somehow providing some sort of a measure of border control. Having said that, it should be slightly easier if you are being deployed in the Eastern Mediterranean, in between the Greek and the Turkish sort of maritime area, because the sea lanes, the areas where you ferry and you cross around are fairly well known. So it's slightly more sort of constrained space that you have to monitor. But unless you are given a task to proactively do something about it, a warship would probably intervene just when they see a ship that is about, or boat, or you know, whatever it is that is floating about, that is about to capsize and save people. At that point, what do you do? Unless they have migration control officials on board, there's not much you can do about it other than put them to the closest nearby port. Mare Nostrum was different because he had border control officials. They got doctors from the Ministry of Health, because it was designed not just to rescue people and bring them in, but to sort them out on the ship before you get ashore, so you know what you're doing. That's a measure short of what has been suggested earlier on, addressing the root causes, which is a completely different story.
James, if this ultimatum is not met and Greece don't sort this all out in 3 months, it does occur to me, just looking at a map of Europe, that there is a potential nuclear option available to the EU, and that is Greece, while it is a member of the Schengen area, is geographically detached from the Schengen area by the Balkans being in between it. Is it feasible that Greece could be actually or threatened with being bounced out of Schengen?
Well, it's certainly feasible in the sense that it could be done, but I mean, politically one imagines it would be highly undesirable. I mean, the European Union, let's set aside Brexit or the prospect of it for a moment, the European Union has got enough to think about without sort of forcing suspension on one of its member states from one of its key things, the ultimate, if you like, in the free movement of goods and people. So I think that would be considered very much a nuclear option.
OK, well, let's look now here at the UK, where newsstands will have two gaps on them by the end of next month. The Independent and The Independent on Sunday are to discontinue their print editions, though The Independent will continue as an online publication. The Independent's condensed version, The Eye, is to be sold, and The Independent's owner, Evgeny Lebedev, said the move, that this decision preserves The Independent brand and allows us to continue to invest in the high-quality editorial content that is attracting more readers to our online platforms, which I think translates as we're not retreating, we're advancing in the opposite direction. Alessio, is there any reason you can see to be optimistic about the Independent's future?
I'm an old-fashioned person, that's why I'm wearing a bow tie, which means that I like my paper, you know, the hard copy version, the hard copy of something is the one that I prefer. I still buy books, you know, I find very uncomfortable to do the electronic version of
things. Yeah, I agree completely. I read on screens for work, I read paper for pleasure.
Exactly right, so spot on, exactly, that's exactly my same position. So, yes, I can see the advantages and, you know, saving the environment and all the other bits and pieces and stories that you can put forward, but it seems to me the way it's been presented, as you say, it suggests that on the surface it's been presented as like, well, this is a great innovative idea. In practical terms, I'm not so sure about it. And I'm rather sceptical in this respect, because people who tend to read online or focus on online visual engagement, correct me if I'm wrong, but they're looking for a different type of content as well. So that sort of opens up a broader debate, a very important debate, as to how you deliver high quality information to a broader audience, and in what ways you should educate the audience to push themselves a bit further, or you just sort of get used to what they want, which necessarily is not the trend that you'd like to keep, to have that kind of high end of product.
But James, to what extent, and I should declare an interest at this point in that I wrote for The Independent and The Independent on Sunday for many years, and I worked with some remarkably decent and talented and clever and hardworking people there, all of whom I wish obviously nothing but the best. But in recent years, the reason that I'd stopped writing for The Independent, the reason I know a lot of other people had stopped writing for The Independent, was that it frankly barely paid. It became, from a freelance journalist's point of view, increasingly not worth taking stories to it. And I guess I'd just ask you, is it in any respect the victim of those self-inflicted diminishing returns? Was its problem not so much the internet, but the fact that a lot of what it was printing or that it was just basically that it was under-resourced?
I think it may well have been under-resourced. I mean, talking based on conversations I had with contacts of the paper over the last 12 months or so, you mentioned the I, it's sort of cut-down version. That was what was keeping the print, the bigger print titles afloat, as far as I understand, in terms of revenue. That's where the money was coming from. And now that that has gone from the independent stable, if you like, quite a lot of newspapers, I mean, thinking in this country or indeed globally, if one talks to the Financial Times and the Guardian, they've successfully implemented digital first strategies, but digital only, which is in effect what the independent is proposing to do, is something quite distinct from that. So I think it probably was to some extent, and it's a great shame. I mean, the newspaper has got some excellent writers, particularly on international affairs.
Indeed so.
And one can only hope that their work is going to continue to find a fairly wide audience. And one understands, of course, that the daily sales of the newspapers weren't great. But it's difficult, even with the greatest respect to Mr. Lebedev, looking through his statement today, it's difficult to really draw the positives from it, I think.
Just to follow up your point about the online-only nature of what they're now proposing, is there any extent to which you think that the newspaper may have been a victim of the internet, not in the way that everybody's assuming it is, but of the fact that its own website, which is its most seen presence in the world is, I mean, it's terrible. It's really bad. A lot of what it actually prints is clearly, you know, written by, to put it charitably, inexperienced journalists. The actual design of it is eye-watering. When you measure it against the sort of the relatively clean website designs of something like its obvious rivals, especially The Guardian and The Times, is that a factor? The fact that just the actual website wasn't very good and that reflected badly on the print publication?
I mean, I think it probably is because I'm quite a regular, I'm quite a regular reader of the title, actually, and occasionally if I read something my way into work in the morning, I might want to share it on social media later, and it's quite hard to find it sometimes, even though it's their own stories. The website was, you know, occasionally pretty difficult to navigate, I think. I mean, if I may, I think there's one big concern here for UK newspapers as well, and that is the variety of ownership. There's one title is disappearing here, only, well, two titles if you include the Sunday, but I think in terms of how it's going to leave the bigger British newspaper market, that's a big concern in terms of the editorial political viewpoints which are being expressed in this country.
Alessia, what's your, you were saying there earlier that like both of us, you prefer to read on paper. Is it important, do you still think, not just because it's a nicer thing to read, but that it gives a title, a publication, a certain gravitas to actually have a print version? Even, you know, even a product of the digital age like Politico produces an actual paper edition. Does that matter?
I think so. I think it matters because, and again, there is a very much of a wide debate, and this is a debate that it doesn't just belong to the news industry. You go to universities now, one of the biggest debates is to the extent to which you should get rid of physical books and go to electronic versions of everything. And so you have very different opinions. I still believe that there is a sense of gravitas. There is a certain sense of commitment, something that is printing that comes out as a sort of a hard version. It stays there.
Okay, well, finally tonight, it is just 92 days until the final of this year's Eurovision Song Contest, which is well worth staying alive for. One of the few consoling joys of the thing is the occasional use of this global platform by some country with a grudge to smuggle a thinly veiled political allegory into proceedings. It looks tantalisingly like Ukraine may be that country this year. Among leading contenders to be their representative is Jamala, whose family not only hails from Crimea, annexed by Russia in 2014, but plans to sing a song entitled 1944 about the deportation of her Tatar forebears by Stalin. Here's a very short bit of it.
We could build a future where people are free to live a long, the happiest time, hard time.
Very briefly, gentlemen, do we think we have a winner there? James Rogers.
I doubt it. I mean, you say it's 92 days away. One doesn't know what's coming, but I'm going to be bold and say that's probably not going to win. I mean, what I would be looking forward to, as always, is the voting. Well, it's not shown in full in this country anymore, because obviously
it would take you days.
It's politics at its finest.
The thing I like about this, though, is that she's complaining that her followers in Crimea can't vote for her in the heat. Of course, they will be able to vote for her, presumably if they're phoning from Russia, the final, whereas her fellow Ukrainians won't be able to. Russia may just have lost themselves Eurovision. Alessio, what do you think? Do we have a winner there?
Well, certainly for the audience, certainly for the broader audience outside the context. You know, I didn't know about the song. I'm not a regular follower, but certainly it's an intriguing story. And you know, that is important as well, as how you reach out to different type of people that will keep that kind of debate alive.
We will have to leave it there, unfortunately. Alessio Patilano, James Rogers, thank you both very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Carlotta Rabello and Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Ida May Griffiths and Yasmin Omar. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. For the next half hour, Carlotta Rabello is playing music on the Atlantic Shift. Marcus Hippie follows that at 1900 with The Menu. At 2000, Ben Ryland's Cinema Show. Remember, more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I think I'm right in saying Peter Cardwell is your host for that. But for now, from me, Andrew Muller, it's goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.